We'll resume now with the two other speakers. And actually, in a way, having the break like that is good, I think, because in a way, these two speakers have more in common with each other than they do with what I was talking about in a certain sense, because they're both going to be talking about what we should do about politics and political strategy now, as opposed to economic analysis. So over to John Smith.
Hi, thanks a lot. Well, actually, before I start talking about social strategy, etc., which is what Jamie asked me to concentrate my remarks on, I want to actually bring a new dimension into the analysis of the crisis, right? Or to bring out something which Jamie touched on, which is seems to me critical, and none of what I have to say about how to get out of the crisis will make sense unless I amplify on this, and that is that Jamie's main point was that the huge expansion of debt, massive growth of leveraging, the relaxation of regulation on finances, etc., was aimed at trying to alleviate or rescue the capitalist economy from a major systemic crisis of the 60s and 70s. And I totally agree with Jamie on that. I'm completely at one with him on that, except I think it's only one aspect of the measures which capitalism took to try and rescue itself from the crisis. The other was the massive global shift of production to low-wage countries, outsourcing. Jamie mentioned about how there was major capitalist investment going on in China. The reason why it was taking place in China and East Asia, and not just there, in Morocco, in Mexico, along the in the Maquiladora, along the border with the United States and many other places, was because basically the crisis that Jamie talked about in the 60s and 70s, crisis of profit, the way that the capitalists tried to restore their rate of profit, the only way that capitalists can restore their rate of profit is through massive cutting of costs, and we know that labour costs are really the costs that matter here. The capitalists were not able to come to us in the 60s and 70s and saying, look, to get out of this crisis, we're going to have to cut your wages by 50, 60, 70%, because they knew they'd have a revolution on their hands. But they were able to move production to where wages were a tiny fraction of what they were in the rich countries. And so outsourcing of production and the financialisation of the economies in the rich part of the world were the two transformations, the two medicines which they prescribed to actually treat the ills of capitalism. And really the crisis that we've entered into with the credit crunch beginning in 2007 can be best understood as side effects of the medicines prescribed to treat the underlying crisis. So the massive growth of debt, deregulation, the unrestricted allowing finance to do whatever it wanted, clearly that has had huge side effects, the big side effect being the collapse of the world financial system, the collapse of the banking system. Outsourcing, where does that fit in? It seems to me it's extremely important, and it's the one side of it which is left out of most accounts, mainstream and even radical. First of all, to actually see why outsourcing is so important, I did actually prepare a handout for this talk. My computer wouldn't work this morning, so I couldn't print it out for you, but this is one I prepared earlier, right? So actually, not all of the graphs on this are directly relevant to what I have to say, but certainly graphic number three is, that shows one of the consequences of the outsourcing, which is the shift in the centre of gravity of the global working class to the south. At the beginning of this crisis, the total number of industrial workers in the what I call the imperialist countries, Britain, North America, Europe, Japan, was approximately equal to the total number of industrial workers in the global south. But now, as you can see from that graph, something like approaching 80% of the world's industrial workers are to be found in low-wage countries. But one of the consequences of this, so the capitalists managed to, one of the ways that they sought to restore their rate of profit was through massive cost-cutting through outsourcing of production to low-wage countries by substituting much lower-wage labour in China, etc., replacing high-wage labour at home with low-wage labour abroad. This allowed, this has had a mighty effect in helping to restore the rate of profit. But it has actually created gigantic distortions. For reasons which I'm happy to go into if you want to ask a question about it, the The resulting structural trade surplus, which China and other manufacturers exporting nations have as a result of producing all of the stuff, practically every single item of clothing, every single electronic gadget we're using here is made in some sweatshop in some low-wage nation now. And because there is a structural trade surplus, they are accumulating large amounts of hard currency. And for reasons which I could go into, the only thing they can do with this money is to lend it back to the rich countries. So we have a perverse reverse Marshall Plan. After World War II, the United States lent Europe the money it needed to buy the product of US factories. Now it's China lending the US the money it needs to buy the products of Chinese factories. And China cannot do anything else with this money. For one thing, if China didn't lend the US the money, the US government, etc., would have to go to the private sector to borrow this money. Rates of interest would then go up. You would then have a global recession. China would no longer be able to excel all this stuff. So China is basically, Lawrence Summers, who President Obama appointed as his chief economic advisor before he took that post, said that he described this situation. He said that basically the world was being run on the basis of what he called a financial balance of terror. It's like as if the United States was pointing a gun at its own head, saying to China, Brazil and other low-wage countries, hand over your money or else I will shoot. Right? That's how, and that's basically what Lawrence Summers was saying, that's how the world was being run. And as a result, this is why when Jamie mentioned how every time the economy showed signs of slipping into a recession, the US government and the European Central Bank and so on would step in by slashing interest rates to try and stimulate the economy and stop a runaway situation developing. The question then arises, how come the US government and Europe, etc., were able to cut interest rates and still borrow money at these lower interest rates? How come they were not forced to raise interest rates? If you've got the United States with a massive structural trade deficit, selling only half of the merchandise goods in value terms than it was actually purchasing, how come the United States wasn't forced to raise interest rates much earlier, which would have obviously cut off the recession, etc.? The reason is because of all this free money coming from China and other poor countries. This flood of money from low-wage countries helping to finance the trade deficit and the excess consumption of the rich countries was the crucial factor in helping the West, the rich countries, maintaining extremely low interest rates. Very low interest rates then has two effects. One is that it encourages people to feel that they can afford to borrow more money, so it encourages more leveraging, more debt. The second thing it does is that financial intermediaries who are responsible for investing depositors' funds have to go and look for more and more risky places to put their money in order to get any kind of a return. What was called a desperate hunt for yield caused financial intermediaries to pour money into things like subprime loans, etc. So the two things which the main media have blamed as the cause of the crisis, which is excessive leveraging, excessive risk-taking, themselves were consequences of the free money being supplied by some of the poorest countries in the world to the richest countries in the world to help finance their excessive consumption. In other words, a result of outsourcing. This is why it seems to me outsourcing is so extremely important as a part of this thing. And you can see some of the examples of it on the back here. What we have with the last 30 years of globalization is global integration. Jamie talked about the relaxation of restrictions on the mobility of capital, finance capital, and also factories, etc. One thing that's really quite startling is how the one factor of production, the one commodity which is exempt from this law of deregulation of global flow is labour. The only factor of production which has actually found that instead of barriers to international mobility of labour being relaxed, we've on the contrary had electrification of frontiers. We've had sort of fortress Europe. We've got tens, hundreds, thousands, even millions of people being dressed in uniforms and given guns to stop workers from moving freely across borders. If you look at the border between the United States and Mexico, factories can cross that border. The owners of the factories can cross the border. The things that come out of the factories can cross the border. The money that the factories generate in form of profits can pass through the border. The only thing which cannot pass through that border is Mexican workers. Same for Europe. And it's that restriction on the free movement of labour which has itself created gigantic differentials in wages between rich and poor countries. That itself then generates this momentum, this enormous motive for capitalists operating in the rich countries to move their production to poor countries. And that's what we've seen on a grand scale. One of the effects of this, it seems to me, when we look at the United States, Britain, Europe and so on, is that more and more of the population who are employed in Britain, in Europe, United States, are involved in non-production activities. This partly explains, this is part of the answer to the question that was raised earlier on, it seems to me, about how it is that sort of declining wages doesn't actually result in higher profits, because a lot of the wages that are declining are wages for people who are not actually producing any value. They are in non-productive sectors such as banking, advertising, and many other sectors which have seen a much bigger a big increase in the proportion of the employed population, whereas industry, etc., has been shrinking as part of the US and British, etc., economies. What's really been happening is that the rich countries have been more and more parasitic on the rest of the world. More and more of the wealth that is being produced and captured by northern capitalists is actually now being produced in low wage, in factories, in export processing zones across the world. And so what you've got then is sort of, yes, there is a higher rate of exploitation in the United States itself, but there's a much bigger amount of capital that this surplus value has to be shared out among them. Without going into detail of it, it is very interesting that one of the main points that Karl Marx wanted to make in Capital, he said that the rate of profit falls not because workers are less exploited, but precisely because workers are more exploited. The effect of increasing the rate of exploitation is a fall in the rate of profit, not a rise in the rate of profit. And that's because replacing capital with labour, labour with capital, etc. Anyway, so I've introduced the whole dimension of outsourcing, and I'll just want to say a quote here from Karl Marx, 1867, same year that the first volume of Capital was published. And this is the main point in a very brief address to the Lausanne Congress of the International Working Men's Association. And he said, "A study of the struggle waged by the English working class reveals that in order to oppose their workers, the employers either bring in workers from abroad or else transfer manufacturers to countries where there is a cheap labour force. Given the state of affairs, if the working class wishes to continue its struggle with some chance of success, the national organisations must become international." 1867. I just think that those words, it's just astonishing, the prescience. That's something that was just incipient 140 years ago. But those words define our age. There is nothing more fundamental about the world that we're now living in and about the dilemma facing working people. In 1867, or in the decades following it, the international working class movement showed itself quite capable of organising on an international level. At least it showed its potential to be able to do that. The struggle for a 40-hour week was an international struggle that was coordinated by the First International and the Second International. There was great deal of international coordination of labour struggles. This was at a time before telephones, before aircraft, before, you know, all the means of communication and transport. Now it seems that our trade unions are completely and totally incapable of organising on an international basis. There's just absolutely none of this happening. And it seems to me that the precondition, that the biggest obstacle, the reason why there hasn't been a fight back, and the biggest obstacle to developing a working class resistance is the failure of the working class movement in the rich countries to develop an internationalist perspective, to put its privileges and its chauvinistic, Eurocentric attitude to one side, and to actually champion the rights of all working people. I would argue that objectively, the working class movement has been enormously strengthened by the last 30 years. The working class is more global. It's a very good thing that there are tens and hundreds of millions of new workers, mainly women, because that's who's working, making all our shoes and clothing and stuff in these export processing zones. The working class is much more global. The working class is much more female, even within the European, North America, etc. We've seen since World War II the incorporation of huge numbers of women into the workforce. The working class is no longer a male phenomenon. The working class is much more cosmopolitan. Despite immigration controls, despite the tightening of immigration controls, we've had a tremendous movement of labour between countries, helping to break down national particularisms, helping to bring experiences of struggle from one country to another. One of the things which objectively strengthens the working class in this country, in Europe and in North America, more than anything else, is migration of workers from third world countries. And we should embrace that, and we should champion it. And we should say that no worker, this is what the workers in the United States were saying in their huge demonstrations 2 or 3 years back, when you had in the United States, it didn't get much publicity in this country, but it's got enduring significance. We had in the United States about 3 years ago on May Day, what really was a political general strike in the United States. Millions upon millions of workers, mainly migrant workers, walking out of their meatpacking plants and their construction sites and their sort of tomato plantations, etc., to take part in gigantic demonstrations. On two occasions in Los Angeles, you had demonstrations of more than 1.5 million people. In Dallas, there's 400,000. In Chicago, 900,000. Absolutely massive, gigantic demonstrations of migrant workers saying, we are not aliens, we're workers, and saying that no human being is illegal. These were the sort of demands that they were putting forward. And it seems to me that the life and death question for the working class movement in this country is to unconditionally defend the right of migrant workers to a job, to a house, to everything that we've got. We can't defend those things for ourselves if we're not going to defend them for other workers. We have no right to those things ourselves unless we say that also other workers have got a right to them. There was a big demonstration of migrant workers and asylum seekers in Cologne in 1999, and they put themselves at the head of a big demonstration with this big banner, and they said, we are here because you have destroyed our countries. And we have to see that the only way that we'll ever get a path towards socialism, which I think this crisis now makes it objectively necessary that the world begins a transition to socialism, that is the only way out of this crisis. We will not be able what that actually means is that the path to socialism lies through overcoming the enormous differences in living standards and life chances between working people in different parts of the world. We will not get to socialism in Britain so long as we have poverty in Africa and other places. Only through struggling against that, only through struggling for the common interests of working people on an international scale, can we talk about socialism. Everything else is cant and reactionary, in my opinion. I don't know how long I've been speaking here, but it's probably about the time to finish. Yeah. All I would say is that...
A couple of minutes. Yeah.
To conclude, then. Yeah. To conclude, it's been pointed out by various economists, Martin Wolf in the Financial Times just a few days ago, Nouriel Roubini and others, that basically the main consequence of the measures that the governments of Europe and North America and Japan, the consequence of the measures they've taken to try and stop the economy from going into meltdown, is to inflate new and even bigger asset bubbles. We have what we call zero interest rate policy, or near zero interest rate policy. This was described by a banker at Morgan Stanley as crack cocaine for the financial markets. It's a very, very brilliant description. What it means is that if you're extremely rich, you can borrow money from the United States government or from the British government at practically zero interest rate. You then go and invest it in stocks and shares, or you convert it into another currency and invest it in Brazilian real or whatever, and you're able to go and make gigantic profits. There's bigger profits, bigger fortunes being made now than ever in human history. People who borrowed money in US dollars in March of last year reinvested it in stocks and shares in Brazil. This has an effect. The more you sell the currency that you borrow in, the more the value of that currency falls. That means that the size of the debt that you owe drops, which is what you want. That's very good. The more you buy into a currency, when you change those dollars for real, for sake of argument, that bids up the price of the real. So you make a profit because of the increasing value. Right? Anyway, the point is that they made 140% profit. The point is their only solution is to inflate new and ever bigger asset bubbles. We cannot underestimate the scale of this crisis. This crisis is many times bigger than the crisis which led to World War I and led to World War II, and now it has an ecological dimension to it as well, which is why I agree with the Cuban economist Raul Valdez Vivo, who said it's a crisis of capitalism without a way out, and that we need to begin the transition to socialism, and we need to see that as an international, see ourselves as part of the world. So, okay, thanks.
So, perhaps we can have maybe perhaps just 5 minutes of sort of questions, perhaps a clarification of John's talk, and then move on then to Ian's talk, and then perhaps we'll have time for a bit wider discussion at the end. So, any questions to John?
Quick one, probably an impossible question. I think everyone in this room accepts what you're saying. What's the way out of it? I mean, you can say socialism, but then how do we achieve that and socialism in a form which might produce a more stable future for the world population?
Do you want to, anybody wants to ask a question, stick them all together?
Yes.
Well, it's the same theme. I don't think we're going to crack this in 5 minutes. But I mean, it's basically that you know, clearly there is a crisis of capitalism, but there's also, I mean, let's face up to it, there's a crisis of socialism. I mean, that's the big problem that we have. I realise there are social movements happening in other parts of the world that have huge significance, about which too many of us know too little. But I mean, you know, look here in this country, look across Europe, look at the forces of socialism, and they are massively diminished by comparison with, you know, some of the periods that have been referred to in this meeting, especially the 70s, of course, which many of us will remember with some joy. You know, you talk about the culture of work, and Jamie was talking about the way in which we're all, you know, all people in employment are working quicker, working more daily, weekly, and in their lives, being ground down, to use your term.
Mm.
It's not so long ago, we genuinely felt that we were close to a shorter working life, to a shorter working week, to a shorter working day. Mm. Do you remember that?
Mm.
And it wasn't utopianism that. In the 70s, there was a real movement and feeling within socialist forces. I use that term. So it's just to make the point that, yes, I think there is a crisis of capitalism, but there's an equally serious crisis of socialist forces.
Okay. Any other remarks? Okay, well, those two are probably big enough.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, I think one of the things that's really been revealed, and you can see it in Greece now, pretty plainly, is that we talk about Britain, United States, Greece, etc., as being democratic countries, and in a sense they are, but in an even more important sense, they are dictatorships. We have the dictatorship of capital, that when it comes to a crisis, it's their interests which prevail. They will actually cut police and even military spending if necessary, so long as they can continue to service the owners of bonds that Greece, etc., owe their money to. When Jamie was talking about it was necessary to actually take state control over capital and to subject capital to democratic control, well, I could agree with that as a formula, but I think that we need to add a few more things to it. It seems to me in the case of Greece what's necessary, in the case of Britain as well, we have to repudiate the national debt, right? We have to say we're just not going to pay this national debt. Who do we owe this money to? It's private bondholders, it's trillionaires that own this money. Who's piling into Greek debt at the moment because Greece is being forced to pay 4 or 5% over the odds? These people who are borrowing money, this crack cocaine that I mentioned, borrowing money at zero interest from the European Central Bank and investing it in Greece and making fortunes which previously would have taken generations to make. But we have to just cancel. So in other words, it's expropriate finance capital. We have to do that. Now, it's not an easy thing to do, right? Okay. All I'm saying is that if we want to solve the problem, then we've just got to face up to reality. No matter how much people are burying their heads in the sand and just living in a fantasy world and not facing up to these realities, this is the reality. Nothing less and nothing else will get us away from the alternative, which is fascism and World War III. That is what is facing us, in my opinion. So all I would say is that the one country on earth which has managed to protect its population is Cuba. That's the only country that's achieved a sustainable, that lives within the carbon footprint and has achieved a high human development index, that is able to protect its population. Although things are far from perfect there, I totally would accept that. There is a crisis of socialism in Cuba as well. But the big problem in Cuba is that they are the only people in the whole planet who's trying to do this. The very fact that Cuba could even survive as the only country on earth that's trying to plough this furrow, and I'd say the example of what Cuba is doing in Haiti, that is the example of what we need. In Haiti, at the moment, there are 1,500 Cuban doctors. Cuba has actually trained free of charge 500 Haitian doctors. They were there for 12 years before the earthquake happened. Anyway, that's the spirit that we need to get out of this crisis.
Okay, we better some provocative ideas. Ian Robert is going to speak about responding to the economic and ecological crisis.
I'm going to talk from here if I can. Good morning. Thank you all for coming this morning, and thank you for the invitation to speak. I put a little bit of information about what I do outside, and I'll refer to some of these as I go on. There's actually a flyer for a conference that you may wish to take away, and it'd be great to actually see you at in September, on a thing called the End of Tradition, and a lot of what I'm talking about is to do with this. This event is to do with the severance of people, communities, from the environment, from nature, from the resource. And it takes both an historic view and also a very contemporary view, and it's an international conference. Have a look at it, do come along if you get a chance. I'll refer to some of those issues as I go on. There's also things like my little book on the wild side, and I'll put that out because that's some of the media works I do with newspapers, and I do stuff with the BBC, with Radio Sheffield, and some of the other programmes. And it's interesting the reaction that people have to these things. The BBC are paranoid about me doing anything at all controversial, even on local planning issues or wildlife conservation issues. If we say anything at all that is at all sensitive, the producer comes in and says, oh no, retract that, say it's not the BBC, remember Jonathan Ross. The star, I can do anything I like. A lot of it is very, people enjoying nature, but I can also have freedom to actually say what I think about issues. As long as I'm not libelous. The interesting thing today is I've actually taken my university's logo off there as well, because the university have suggested that I shouldn't use their title for these sort of presentations because I'm not actually speaking on behalf of the university, which is an interesting take on academic freedom. Incredible. I'm going to touch on a number of issues. Very light touch. I'm not going to give many solutions. I'm going to hint at things that I feel are possible solutions. I want to try and link the economics to the ecology, I'm an ecologist by training, but I'm also a landscape historian. I've looked at regional economic regeneration, reclamation of derelict sites. I've looked at issues of tourism. I do a lot of work on the history of economics and the way that economic history drives the environment. So I'm interested in these sort of issues. And a lot of the consequences that I see happening today, a lot of the crises, I think began 200 years ago through the process of industrialization, of enclosure of common land, the separation of people from nature, urbanization, and the movement into the cities, which is continuing at a pace across the emerging world today. We are now, for the first time, 50% or more an urban community. And there are big issues to do with that. And I would echo what my colleagues have already said about... about the economic aspects of these. That's our planet, that's our home. A lot of talk about sustainable development refers very little to the actual environmental or ecological resource itself. A lot of sustainability is purely from an anthropogenic view, often from a Western 21st century view of a world to be exploited, and that is it. There's very little talk about ethics, about responsibility for the environment, about custodianship, and I think there are huge issues about that. There's only two buttons, I keep pressing the wrong one. I like this little card because this is my message from a very small planet. It's someone on the deck of the Titanic writing a postcard. Nothing much happening here, how are things with you? And that is what it's like, that's the level. Listen to the political debate at the moment. You know, I use debate in the loosest sense of the word. None of the real crises are being talked about. Politicians have little understanding, in fact, of many of the issues. There's a lot of verbiage, there's a lot of tokenism. and yet, much of what we actually are experiencing today is entirely predictable. And I've said this before, and I upset various people. I upset our vice-chancellor at our university with one of my comments on this, to do with flooding. And I've got a little book out there from a conference I organised at Sheffield Hallam University about flooding. And on ITN, I said, because you get the chance to go live on TV, and you think, well, what the hell, I'll say it. Not only were the Sheffield floods predictable, but they were predicted. 10 years ago, we said there was a problem. Sheffield City Council planners told us Sheffield would never flood again. Here you see Sheffield not flooding again. And yet, the problems are obvious when you look at what we've done. You know, the sort of urban cities, the pollution that we allowed as a necessary evil to generate the wealth that we've created. And there are obvious reasons why we were creating the wealth, there are obvious reasons for the industrialisation of farming, you know, starvation, etc., etc., etc. But the consequence has been things like a displaced footprint, so the peat district moorlands have eroded away because of the air pollution, which of course we always blame on Manchester because the winds come from the west. And that's a major reason then for things like some of the flooding incidents. And some of you will remember the old advert, you know, cooking on gas, and we certainly are cooking on gas. Things are warming up, things are getting hotter. It's not all human-induced, there's a mixture of natural phenomena, natural changes. Climate has always changed, we tend to forget that. But some of the impacts are very, very predictable. Yeah, you have to look at that for a while. I think it's very obvious that there is a crisis. I think it's obvious that there's going to be a crisis. Climate changes, the little ice age. You know, there are all sorts of massive changes in the past. But what we're doing to the planet is actually making it far more difficult for any sort of homeostatic relationship to come into balance. The whole Gaia idea, the planetary response, is somehow being emasculated. And are we engaging people? You know, when we talk about, I go to meetings where people talk about green infrastructure. You know, stop someone at the bus stop. They do not know what green infrastructure was. Oh, I'm going out for a walk in my green infrastructure. We do not talk to people, we do not engage people. And if we don't, then we have huge, huge problems. And yet the economics work that myself and others have done shows the colossal value of a good environment. The old idea in Sheffield, of course, was where there's muck, there's brass. and there is for some, but as we've heard, the money can move around, the money can move to different areas. The environmental degradation stays where it is, and the finance moves on, the capital moves on. But we actually know now that a good environment is good for people. We talk about quality of life, we talk about health agenda, we talk about regional economies. North West England, for example, the Regional Development Agency commissioned work, and that showed about £2.6 billion a year as gross added value of a good environment. And you get the same thing in reverse. If you have a bad environment, you lose investment, you have a deterioration in the quality of life, you have a deterioration in health as a consequent cost to that. But of course, capital can easily move. You crap on one area and you move on to the next. Entirely fluid. One interesting result that we have is a legacy of heavy metal. Those who grew up in the 1970s and 80s in Sheffield will remember Saxon and people like that, Def Leppard. But actually, in a serious way, we have a colossal degradation of the watercourses like the River Rother. The sediments there, grossly contaminated with dioxins, mercury, cadmium, zinc, whatever else you want. We were actually the number two worst polluted river in Europe. We're trying to get to number one, but you know, we can't make it. The Ruhr was actually on fire, so I think they pulled it out. The western suburbs of Sheffield are all grossly contaminated with lead. That comforts me when I look to the rich suburbs of totally in places. Their gardens are full of lead. It's not dangerous, it's locked in the soil, it's not actually biologically active. You could go into the rivers, take sediment samples, you'll still find the legacy of the medieval lead smelting industry of places like Tockley Bowl and other places. These are major, major impacts. And of course, the scary thing is now these impacts happen around the world, but they happen where, in some cases, we maybe took 200 years, they're taking 20 years to do the same sort of things. I've done work on regional wetlands, on Yorkshire's lost fens. 99% at least of the regional wetlands gone. That was all a wetland drained in about 1700. And now intensive farming. And that is another reason why we have both droughts and we have catastrophic floods, and there is a huge cost to that. We polluted the rivers. Salmon pastures, where there was local legislation to prevent the factory owners feeding fresh salmon to their workers on too many days of the week, because that was considered, you know, not good. By the 70s, we had a few mutant sticklebacks with several eyes and whatever. The rivers are now actually clean again. We have 12 or 14 species of fish back in these watercourses, but there's still a legacy of toxicity locked away in the sediments that people don't want to talk about. And where we didn't just pollute the rivers, we canalised them and we culverted them, we cajoled them. This should have been on a wide, rich floodplain. This was a natural capacity of the ecosystem to work with us to prevent flooding, etc. And we just control and try and constrain it, and then we are surprised when there are problems. We've also introduced all sorts of alien species. I did my PhD on alien species many years ago before it was an exciting and acceptable topic to do. It was considered a bit zany then. But we know that the cost of dealing with the problems of exotic species is around £3 billion a year, and it's increasing exponentially. The only places where there's been real action, there's a lot of talk about it, a lot of rubbish talked about it, but the only place where there's been real action to deal with it, a place like Swansea City Council and in Cornwall County Council, where they employ people to actually manage the spread of the exotic species. And the reason they did that in Swansea, for example, was that they realised that the cost of remediation was actually starting to have a big impact on inward investment. Factories would not move to those areas to relocate because the cost of managing a site and controlling the plant could amount to several million pounds. And therefore you go to Luton instead of Swansea. So these are real, real costs. But we've done all sorts of things over recent years. This is a woodland in Sheffield bulldozed a few years ago to make way for a roadway. No environmental assessment, ancient woodland, totally removed from the map. And another one actually is still there, but effectively bulldozed with public funded conservation management. We all pay for that, for a private forestry company that's supposedly sensitive copies management of a woodland, utilising a bulldozer. And then we wonder why we have problems. Some key points I want to make. The amounts of shared responsibility, the crisis in climate change are not that new. The global human footprint which we're seeing is unprecedented, and there's a massive scale of rapid environmental degradation impacts, of human suffering, of economic crisis, of biodiversity loss, and much more. And a lot of, you know, you listen to the politicians, and it's kind of business as usual. You can track the history of the environmental movement with things like seminal moments of the Silent Spring with Rachel Carson, Limits to Growth and the Club of Rome. Everyone said, oh, these people are complete fruitcakes. Absolute, you know, blueprint for survival, load of rubbish. And someone did an assessment of it recently and said, actually, it all happened. We've gone through various strategic approaches to these issues, nature conservation strategies. You may remember the Asian fires and Indonesian crisis, tourism just cut off when fires were burning all across Indonesia and elsewhere, and the forests were up in flames, again due to some rather dodgy financial dealings by senior politicians. And I remember a very senior environmental economist from London coming onto the radio and saying, well, crisis, what crisis? These environmentalists have been predicting these crises and it's never come to fruition. I think, hang on, you've just had a tourism industry across that whole area shut down for 6 months because of the pall of smoke, and you're saying there's no crisis? We've also, close to home, have things like foot and mouth and BSE and all the rest of it, and these are all entirely expected and predictable because of the situation and the way that we've managed the environment. So we're in a crisis now, surprise, surprise. Do we hear about any of it in terms of the political debates? No, we don't. Basic facts, sustainable development, yes, because development is change, it's evolution. Sustainable growth, no, it's simply not possible. But you say we can't have sustained growth, the economic system goes, oh, what do? We now have an environmental crisis, we have an economic crisis, we have huge and increasing social tensions. We've been doing some research at our university on the idea of the triple bottom line, looking at these three issues, the environment, the economy, society, and trying to evaluate projects and investment in terms of these. We know that we can have great value added from the environment and from community-related issues, but there is a price to pay. And as a society, we are not willing to pay that price. All the debate now is about cuts. We are not willing to invest. We are not willing to pay the price to derive the benefits. This is not new. There are fundamental problems with the market-led approach in this. All the issues of commons and common usage. There are selective and subjective placements of values and valuations, which often make no sense. There are all sorts of issues about free goods and services, and also in the past what you could do in terms of you're affluent, so you can exploit the aspects of the environment, but you can dispose of your rubbish free of charge into the river, into the environment, whatever. A huge issue about the environment is long-term. Decision-making, economics and politics are inherently short-term. And there's this disconnection from nature, which I touch on in the conference. In close to home, as a conservationist, a nature conservationist by background, massive separation now, I think, between environmentalism and nature conservation. And the two do not understand each other, and neither really understand economic processes or the games that people play with economics. There's a lack of public investment to trigger the wider economic benefits, but we know there's benefits there. We know now that you get savings for the health service by a good environment. You know that you get quality of life and you get health benefits and economic benefits through these things. But this is not what politicians want to hear when you say to get these benefits you have to invest. All sorts of issues which are consequences of this often paternalistic, naive approach to the environment, an approach which has a deep lack of respect for environmental sustainability. We're starting to reap where we sow. The floods in 2007 cost over £3 billion in, you know, the immediate quantitative impact. That Sheffield not flooding again, we'll move on from that. The Guardian, I think it was, recently had some pictures showing possible flood level increases. The flood defence bill will double to about £1 billion a year, and there are issues about if it rises, 2 metre level, sea level rise, huge chunk of Yorkshire goes. They're talking now about rolling back Grimsby. Depends what, you know. We don't talk about these things in real terms. We talk about it as, you know, we're going to roll back coal, we're going to roll back infrastructure, we're going to roll back Grimsby. If you've been to Grimsby, apologies for anybody from Grimsby. That's what happens if it's a higher level rise. You know, a huge area just goes and there's not an awful lot you can do about it. So these are really big, serious issues. A little bit ago we were talking about, oh, it'll be a metre or so, you know, half a metre. Then it's now a metre. Well, that probably means that 50 years it'll be 1.5 metres or 2 metres. The bulk of the central part of London along the Thames goes. And we've got the Thames Barrier. But Thames Barrier, of course, also holds water when it comes down from inland flooding, as well as water that comes up from the sea. So if you get the two happening at the same time, as we nearly had a tidal surge in the autumn of 2007, got to about 6 inches of overtopping the barriers along the east coast. If you got that at the same time as a flood like we had in Sheffield, then it's bye-bye London. There's a big squeeze, particularly along the east coast, massive erosion, and the scale of these events is increasing exponentially. You know that the scales of hurricane impacts have increased by an order of magnitude in the States, and that has consequences for us as well. And coast erosion is increasing in some places. Say in Scotland, colleagues have reported increases where it was maybe 1 metre a year has increased to 10 to 100 metres in a single storm incident. So massive, massive impacts. And the agencies and politicians are saying we will have coastal realignment, we will roll back infrastructure. That is actually, we will do nothing. But we don't say that. We have new words. It was called, at one point, it was called managed retreat. But in the Blairite government, that was considered too defeatist. It's coastal realignment, it's not managed retreat. I told you so. Limits to growth and all these things that came out in the 70s and 80s, people have reviewed them, and actually most of the predictions have come true. And yes, a lot of the literature sort of poo-poos all these radical ideas from that time. There's a lot of issues about language, of exclusion, of power games that people play. And the only actions, as I can see, moving forward, there's this whole thing about internationalisation, and I think the internet is a fantastic potential tool for that, to link people up. But we need to look at local actions to global visions, issues of communication, awareness, education, which I would say as a university person, we need a degree of resolution, we need champions, but individuals can and do and must make a difference. That's where the book stops. Politicians and elections listen to the so-called debate now. We need less hot air and more action. But that's not what we get. I just took a few headlines from papers over the last few weeks. I will end take it or leave it public services. For a start, this is a government that's been in for quite a long time. So, I mean, and also, what does that mean? When he came into power, he upset me because he immediately said, you know, the public sector will have to take the brunt of the cuts. Why? I think we've just bailed out the banks. I thought that was private sector, but I must be misunderstanding something. So I don't mind that. Universities' cuts will bring us to our knees. I mean, there are issues about maybe what universities deliver sometimes, but I'll not go down that route. But also, I can demonstrate the economic benefit of universities, say, two universities in Sheffield, in terms of the local economy, of employment, of creative ideas, of future wealth, etc., etc., but also the direct tourism impact of universities to the UK in terms of bringing overseas students and their families, etc., etc. It's massive. You never hear about that in the media. You never hear the universities actually giving any reference to that at all, or the university's role in addressing these crises in the future. And then, on the other hand, we get the DIY revolution. Well, I'm sorry, I actually don't want to do it myself. I want good professionals to do what I want them to do as a community. I don't expect to have to do it myself as an amateur. It kills the economy, it threatens the environment. Sheffield City Council already announced, I think, somewhere near 1,000 jobs going in the leisure services, which includes the environment and countryside areas. Massive, massive impact on delivery of any of the targets that have been set. There's a glimmer of hope when you see headlines like that, because only public intervention can rebuild a rate economy, and I would go along with that. And I think where we're very, very poor at actually giving an argument is the cascade effect, the snowball effect of that sort of intervention, because you can actually put money in, but actually that creates more wealth as you develop. We need to, this is the opposite to the George Bush effect, we need to think global and act local rather than think local and act global. It's through an engagement, education, awareness, empowerment, ownership, action, responsibility. Anywhere you look across the world, you cannot have responsibility unless you have all the other things that go along with that. And you have to engage people, and I don't believe at the moment we do. What I'd ask the politicians is, do we have a cunning plan? And I suspect not. That's probably about the level of it. We know, we've got some of the facts and figures. And Stern, when the report came out, he now says that was a conservative estimate. The real costs are going to be catastrophic. If you listen to Al Gore, he also says there are opportunities to create wealth on the back of dealing with these issues. And what I don't see in the UK economy, particularly from the business sector, from the capitalist and investment sector, is people actually doing that. I don't see them investing big time in creating wind turbines, in creating coastal energy generation systems. We're actually having to import it from other countries. And then when there's a crisis in that, we're caught out. I just don't see why we can't be driving some of that ourselves and generating some of the wealth and the jobs on the back of those things. You know, we celebrate when we get the potential in Sheffield to build some of the steel structures for nuclear power stations. I think I would, and from a steel industry point of view, I empathise with that, but I'd rather it was something like wind turbines or tidal generation or something. There are some big things happening, because one of the problems with the climatic situation and the global environment is we are breaking the whole system up. The system no longer functions. David Bellamy, for example, has taken a lot of flak for his views about climate change, but there is some sense in what he says, that we were all brought up to understand that if you increase temperature, you increase carbon, you increase photosynthesis. Therefore, the whole thing should come back into a cycle. Why isn't it doing? And the reason it isn't doing that is what I've described over 200 years of this process of basically, I better not be rude, but doing bad things to the environment. We've broken up the ability of the environment to function. If the Siberian tundra thaws, it releases methane, it releases carbon, the whole thing starts to fuel itself, and sea level rises, temperature rises, and it gets catastrophically worse. Look at the map if you want to see how big a crisis this is. Almost all the major settlements around the world, major cities, are usually in coastal zones at or below sea level. And as sea level rises and some of the land sinks, then you have got serious, serious problems.
Yeah.
Almost there. So, for most people, you say Britain's climate will be like the south of France. Okay, past the sun cream, that's quite, that's a real threat, isn't it? Now, Sheffield's going to be like the south of France, you better do something, get some cream out. It's easy to forget who it's for. It's for future generations. It's also for the rest of the planet, because we are not on this planet alone. We have to do something. Nobody else will, and thank you for listening.
Any questions, remarks?
I was wondering if you could say something about I've been recently studying quite a lot of climate stuff, and it seems to me that there are still some areas that we really don't know the answers. Like, for example, the increase in CO2 levels theoretically should have maybe led to a more dramatic change than we've already seen. And the things that seem to be unclear is the extent to which the oceans, which are obviously massive, act as a heat sink, and how long it takes to heat them up, and how much kind of buffering they're causing. Then there's also the effects of particulates and black carbon and such like in the atmosphere, which have a combined effect of cooling and warming in terms of reflecting light out, in terms of absorbing more heat, and all of that. And I mean, people probably noticed last week how much bluer the skies were. When I was cycling in here this morning, I looked up at the sky, and actually all the cloud cover this morning was just made up from kind of contrails that have blown out and have created this haze, and we didn't have bluer skies. So we've got, a lot of the things we're doing, and that obviously reflects back a lot of heat out into space again. So a lot of things we're doing don't have a simple effect. And then the other thing is, at what point do we get to the stage where we're in danger of causing a really big qualitative quick change in the kind of the global environment? And do you see that as a possibility? And a slightly bigger question is, have we effectively, has the effect of human industrial civilization And you know, if you actually look back a bit, it goes back further. You know, the first kind of CO2 rises came with agriculture 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. This isn't new, but it's very much more dramatic. It's now kind of exponential. You know, at what point does it get to the stage where we've ended the Holocene?
Mm. There has been an idea of calling the present phase the Anthropocene, as a human-dominated phase of climate. I think there's a huge problem in the way that this is perceived, because it's almost impossible to get the media or politicians to debate the complexities, and what they want are headlines and sound bites, and they want it to be simple. And the fact is that climate change is not simple. So if you look at any of the party political statements at the moment for the election on the environment, it's all to do purely with very, very narrow perceptions of carbon footprints and a few bits about energy and the rest of it, and none of it is really in terms of any wider understanding of what these issues really are. And you go back to the 60s, and everyone, when I was training as a student in the 70s, everything was about the albedo effect, which is, you mentioned, that we were going to be plunged into an ice age. And I remember a documentary on TV where this was being said, you know, you could actually go critically into an ice age, and they'd realised that when ice ages happen, they happen very quickly. They don't happen little bits each year. It just triggers. And one of the factors that showed them this was that they got mammoths out of the Siberian tundra, and they were stood up eating grass or whatever, and it just snowed, and they were preserved in the snow, intact. It snowed, and it didn't stop. So people go, oh my God, if there's this tipping point, what happens? And some guy, you may remember the old Banda machines, those were a bit older, and this guy had run off these Banda sheets saying, insulate now, went around all the houses in Healy, say, insulate now, climate scientists forecast ice age. There are all sorts of issues about the heat systems, the sinks, the circulatory systems, etc. And it is not clear, really, what the issues are. And there are background patterns, and there are systems actually within the planetary cycle, and there's what we're doing to it. If you look carefully at things like carbon, quite a lot of the carbon increases are slightly ahead of the temperature increase. You know, there's a relationship between the two, and they're not quite in some places how they should be. And I think that is to do with agriculture and industrialisation of agriculture and the massive impact on the global ecosystem. And that tends to be missed out of all the contemporary debates. We're going for a single issue, quick fix, because that's what the media demand, that's what politicians demand, and it isn't like that at all. Some of the trigger points and tipping points are very alarming, because you'll all know about the North Atlantic drift, the Gulf Stream. If the Gulf Stream is switched off, which could be a consequence of melting of the northern polar ice, then we don't get warmer, we get a heck of a lot colder, and very, very quickly. And if any of these systems start to go awry, then we have major problems. I think there's also underlying all this, there's a huge issue that we somehow, in an anthropogenic, often very paternalistic, industrialised, human, Christian sort of way, look at the planet and think that we control it, and think that it will always be as it is today. So we can build somewhere, say on a coastal system, and that will always be fixed. And yet history tells us that sea level has gone up and down and changed, and things have changed before. We've lost the ability to adapt. We expect it all to be static, and it isn't. And it's a bit like this idea of infinite growth. You know, the financial system cannot cope with the idea that we are not going to grow today, grow tomorrow, and grow the day after. And yet we know that that is not possible, and yet we deny that it can't be possible. It's very strange.
Can I make a comment?
Please do.
The interrelationship between global warming, the interrelationship between the emission of greenhouse gases and global warming and climate change is extremely complex. None of us, in fact, I'm not a climatologist, but when you look at literature, it's extremely difficult to develop a model which will interrelate between the emission of greenhouse gases and global warming and climate change. But Professor Shackleton at the University of Cambridge, who died recently, did establish, and in my research I found he's the one person who has shown that there is a relationship between environmental changes and climate change and global warming. And the Professor Shackleton at the University of Cambridge is also related to the Reynolds Shackleton that we know. What you have said is absolutely correct. We have ignored environment. We have ignored nature. The first thing is for the Western world to change its way of living. I argue that every new project, whether it's an infrastructure project, an industrial project, or an energy project, whether it is extending the motorways or laying the high-speed train from Sheffield to Newcastle, or indeed any project, should satisfy, in my view, four criteria. We must assess and critically evaluate the effect of that project, both in terms of cost effectiveness and also not only short-term impact, but long-term impact in terms of global warming, climate change, energy resources, infrastructure and environment, and sustainability. It's very easy for a politician, for our government ministers to come and say, we are going to have a high-speed train. It will save you 2.5 minutes when you travel between Sheffield. We will create jobs. You see, we always argue things without any substantiated proof or evidence. I think engineers and scientists now should take over. Every project must be evaluated under those conditions.
Yes.
Yes.
I'll
stop.
Yeah.
Okay. Great discussion. I congratulate anybody who tries to engage with the discussion about economics, because to be honest, I switched off years ago. For me, financial services is one of the great oxymorons alongside military intelligence. In terms of our immediate activity, as somebody who works in the civil service now, and that's always been my choice of job, I'm sure, but 6 years I've been working in the civil service, come the next election, we'll be told that we're going to get big cuts in the public sector, the local government, the civil service. And it's all about jobs, apparently. Now, jobs are sort of a mythical commodity to me, and they always have been ever since I was first made a government. Because a job isn't just some commodity free-floating in this free market. It's a relationship between an employer and an employee to do something. Now, what we have to think more about, and I think the green movement has educated us about it to some extent, is what are we trying to do? You know, people say to me at work, I'm going to get a mortgage. What do you want a mortgage for? You want a place to live, you know. So I think in any discussion we're having around, and it's time to think about it because of an election coming up, is to ask anybody and try and get a sense of what they're trying to do. Where are you going to put the resources that we do have, you know, to create work, to put our efforts into work of real value? John talked about the Cubans putting their resources into doctors. Yeah? We talk about building houses rather than getting mortgages. That's the kind of thing. Like my uncle, who retired from his job in the Volvo factory in Australia. He's an international worker. He's a skilled man. When he retired, he built himself a house. Not satisfied with that, when his wife died, he moved to Thailand and built himself another house. He's 85 next year. You know, there's no end, I believe, and I think this is what we have to put our faith in, is to put human beings' ingenuity, creativity, that we can do things, you know, do good things, and not look at jobs as some amoral commodity, but what are you actually doing creatively, what, you know, in terms of human relationships? anyway, I'm stopping there because, as I say, I'm giving up economics. It's gobbledygook. But I congratulate people trying to engage with the discussion with bloody economists. Moneybox Live is turns me off, you know, every time.
Can I just take 1 minute? We can do things from tomorrow.
Good.
The first thing is, from tomorrow, nobody should drive within the city limits at more than 30 miles an hour. That's number one. Number two, any structure, any housing you build must be self-sufficient in energy and in water. Number three, every building that you build must satisfy certain fundamental ecological criteria. We can do things. But, as you have said, the politicians, I think you know, one other famous saying of Gordon Brown, every child is precious and irreplaceable. My question, every child? Answer yourself.
Thank you. I think we have to wind this up.
We're just getting going.
I'm Liz Hall, I'm chair of Sheffield WA. I'm sorry I wasn't here to start it off, I was dashing to get here. But thank you, Jamie, John and Ian, for an invigorating and lively contributions. I think we've heard some stimulating and intelligent, useful clarifications, ideas and alternatives to what's something I always think about is what we're given out is perceived to be the only way to think. And what we've heard today are different ways to think, and ways to think that I think we probably all subscribe to, all the people in this room, and maybe the people that we engage with subscribe to. So thank you to them. So round of applause. Thank you for giving us to go out into the lovely sunshine, not quite as blue as it was a few days ago, you're absolutely right. I went to my son's wedding in Ireland, where 65 guests couldn't turn up by their flight, by their choice of flight, and came by coach, ferry and coach, from Heathrow to Carlingford Lock. But when we came back, because we were always going by ferry, when we came back through Wales and Manchester, the sky was blue and very, very blue. It really hit me. But anyway, we have got a nice day, so we need to carry these thoughts and ideas out with us into the sunshine. Thank you very much for attending.